guest today is the actor, writer and comic, Catherine Ryan. We began by discussing the tears of a clown.
Tell me about your lockdown number two. How's it been?
I don't like it, but what can I say?
I don't like it either. Can you please make it stop? You're the queen. You have powers.
Well, yeah, I will make it stop next week to an extent.
Gigging wise, did you manage to get anything away? Did you have any Zoom gigs?
I won't do Zoom gigs at all.
Good. Do you know, thank you for that, because I love comedy. I love going to see comedy. Yeah. I will not watch a Zoom comedy gig.
No, and I'm not, and I don't even care if it's disparaging. I'm like, fuck that. No, I won't. No, I won't watch it. It's a disgrace. Like, we don't have to become YouTubers overnight. Like, let's just, we need a union. I think we have one, but we don't use it properly.
I don't want to see comedy highly pixelated with buffering. I don't want jokes to be buffered. You know, I don't want that kind of icky sort of the rhythm of a punchline kind of destroyed by a poor internet provider.
I don't want to be honked at in a parking lot. I don't want to be like, I'm not doing it. So I've just retired basically, which it was about my time anyway.
That's nonsense. You've got to be touring. I bet you're touring everywhere next year.
I'm supposed to, but I'm trying to write it. And it's like, what do you say?
Well, this, okay, you tell me, because I was never really good at stand-up, and you're genuinely
that's a lie.
You're the queen. So, okay, so this interests me, because all creative processes interest me. So you have the proverbial blank sheet. Mm. Usually one fills it with angst, yeah, as a comic. Usually it's filled with unresolved tensions, bitterness, and sexual jealousies.
Ooh.
So that means that you have none of those things going on if you're finding it hard to write. Maybe you're too goddamn happy.
Well, I just feel like we are living in this like dystopia, and I don't know what to even poke fun at anymore. And my problems are not problems. So I have all that. I'm trying to talk about things, but I'm like, shit, like everyone's nana's dead and you don't have your small business anymore. So I just don't feel comfortable.
It's true. I mean, the whole point of a comic is they're supposed to reach out across, yeah, areas of communality, and our experience isn't generalized anymore, because we're just, yeah, sitting in our ivory palaces.
Exactly. And you know, and I saw Ellen's special where she tried to be like my butler, and I was like, whoa,
that went off course so quickly. It's one of the few sets I've seen that made me go into a deep anxiety state,
right?
Because it began as I'm aware of my privilege, but then, yeah, about 2 minutes later, she just got sucked straight back into it.
And I mean, I think I feel for people like her. She's so beloved now that obviously what happened, you're going to step a foot wrong, but also it's not healthy for us to have everyone be like, oh, you're wonderful. That's really bad.
I just say I've never had that. There's always been... No. A juggernaut of detractors that have followed me throughout the flotsam and jetsam of my career.
Yeah, we're very lucky. But I mean, Ellen, when you become, yeah, that in America, there's only one way to go. It's like a kiss of death.
Wouldn't you crave that? Would you crave that ubiquity? And is that something you want?
Me? Absolutely not. No way. I like being niche. Why do you think I moved to one small island?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you've come to a small island facing a great depression.
Jeez, yeah. But I mean, and I'm also offended by her whole takedown, like, oh, she's really mean. What talk show host is not pushed into a situation where they have to be horrible, producing, what, 10 shows a week with 1,000 people knocking at your door? And I'm not saying it's okay to be horrible. It's definitely not okay to be horrible.
Yeah.
But are we talking about Carson being horrible, Letterman being horrible, anyone else being horrible? No, they're just like expected. That's fine. They're horrible, but we love them.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is to do with her being a woman, and also the intersectionality of her being a gay woman. I don't know. And as you say, no one's going to defend a bully. A bully is just a bad bitch all day long. But
yeah.
And jumping on a bandwagon, you know, I think once yes, that's out there, then everyone will pile on with a story so that no one knows the truth.
Right. Is this the podcast?
Yeah, this is it. I'm a soft. This is what Adam Buxton calls a soft launch.
I just thought we lost Dan for a while and we were having a chat.
There's no structure to this, by the way. It's just chat as and when and Love whatever this. Interests you. So during lockdown, I have really embraced the fact that I have quite bad ADHD and nothing has been done. I don't know about you, but nothing. I'll do 5 minutes of a thing. They'll be like, I will land like a butterfly on a moment and it'll be wonderful. And then I will be bored and then something else. And so I look over the last year and the only productive thing I managed to do involved you, where we made this crazy thing in 4 days. For which I'm very grateful.
I loved doing that.
But everything else is a blur. So for you, with no gigs, what have you been doing?
Well, congratulations on the ADHD, by the way, because I'm learning that so many creatives are neurodynamic.
And neurodynamic? I thought we were just neuroatypical. What the fuck is neurodynamic?
My daughter calls it neurodiverse, but I call it neurodynamic. And I think that is our generational gap there. But I mean, the words are getting better and better because we're understanding how genius you are.
So 70% of people in the creative profession and academic profession have some attention issues. Are you one of them?
I don't think so. I think I'm a muggle.
So you can deep dive. You can get into something.
I just have zero anxiety. I really don't care for the most part what people think. I care what my peers think, and I want to be good and do the right thing and be thoughtful and empathetic and virtuous, empathic, I mean, and pathetic. But I mean, I don't get like wound up about things. And if I need to focus on something, I definitely can because I leave everything till last day. I don't know.
I want to learn from the master then, because my entire life is shot through with anxiety and I will go into a wormhole of the one person who's responded negatively to a tweet. And I will spend most of the day, I mean, there's usually more than one person, but like today, there's some guy just bitch guy, you know, I've done my usual sort of screaming into the void about Brexit and COVID and all the rest of it. And there's one sort of retired army major who's needling, and that's going to consume, I would say, between 4 and 6 hours of today.
Well, then I just feel that he has been gifted the right to live in your mind rent free, and he doesn't deserve to be there. And you shouldn't grant him access that way, because you could be doing so many more fruitful things.
But you're right. I need to issue a sort of subconscious eviction order.
You don't owe anyone access to you. And that includes to your thoughts or your consciousness. And if someone's being horrible, that goes with the territory, because no matter what you make, there are going to be people who like it and people who don't. And whoever your heroes are, you look at what they make and there'll be people who really hate that art or work as well. So it's fine. I think people are very much entitled to disagree with me and hate what I do. And I really don't care what they think at all, unless they are like you know, if I had a peer that I really respected and they said, look, Catherine, I don't like what you're doing. It's this or it's that, or I think it's shit. Then I think that would hurt my feelings. But random people who don't create anything but have opinions on what I create, I don't care at all.
So where does that positive mental attitude come from? Does that comes from childhood? That comes from like, you've been given a strong fixed notion of who you are, presumably.
I think so. It's just apathy, maybe, rather than resilience. I don't know. I was always definitely other. I was definitely weird in my community. And I just valued people who were interesting and original and had a unique worldview. Those are the friends that I wanted to have. And then the fact that I was weird and ostracized a little bit.
Were you bullied when you say ostracized?
On and off. So I had years that I was bullied. It had a lot to do with orthodontics. So
yes.
I had some attractive years and then some really weird years. And I'd go in and out of I'd go like in and out of fashion.
Did you have the full cement on like kind of heavy industrial teeth fixers, or did you have, because you were in Canada and I always see Canada as an enlightened society, so maybe you had the Invisalign like in the night. I don't know when you had it.
No, it was the 90s, so there's no Invisalign yet. I had a small jaw, so my teeth were always really straight, but my jaw was small, which actually requires surgery in some cases and pushing out of your entire upper and lower jaw.
So they increased your jaw capacity.
Right. So they did that with a retainer on the inside, which just meant I talk like this. They can't really talk because you have all this like metal inside the roof of your mouth and the bottom. And that was fine, but it pushed my jaw out so quickly that I had a gap between my two front teeth that was massive.
So you had sort of splayed teeth and yes. an expanding jaw.
Yes.
That's a tough thing to take on as a kid.
And I didn't have surgery, but a few of my peers did. They had their jaws broken and then wired shut for 8 weeks. I mean, it's a thing.
Oh, God. Well, that's a culture that really values what people's teeth are like. I mean, yes. You know, in Britain, we don't have that. You know, it's almost a mark of honour if your teeth fall out because you've managed to get enough sugar, which is obviously one of the three main staples of the British diet. But, yeah, I can see how that would be an issue. See, again, I suppose I only know you well enough to form kind of slight, faintly generalized opinions, you know, but it's,
they're I wouldn't, fair.
I knew, I would never, I would, I knew that you wouldn't have been a bully, but I'm surprised that you were occasionally bullied, but I'm interested in the idea of otherness. Go on, you were going to correct me. So
I was a bully for a little while. I became really mean and I didn't bully the types of teenagers that you would see in a film, you know, the really nerdy ones.
Yeah, the geeks.
That you throw a cheese sandwich. I never would bully them, but I just became quite spiky as a defense mechanism. And people remember me as a bully. They'll say, now that I'm on TV or whatever, I see comments and things where they say, I went to school with her and she made everyone's life a living hell. I certainly didn't. I definitely strutted around with my girlfriends as though we were the business and I didn't take any shit. And I would tell everyone exactly what I thought if need be, but I didn't go out of my way to be horrible. And I always remember feeling as though I was defending myself. I was just, I don't know. I think a lot of people who are bullied go back and forth. If you get a chance to be on top, then you're very aggressive with it, defending that position.
But then that forms part of that sort of crystalline sort of comedy persona then, isn't it? It's like, okay, I've learned how to be robust through being bullied and this is what I'm going to present to you. You yeah. can't get one. I mean, no one can get one over. I'm trying to think of anyone who'd be smart enough to get one over comedy persona, Catherine Ryan.
Right.
Because you're like, dealt with you, smashed you. And if they're stupid enough to even try, I imagine they're just atomized.
Right.
And that has to come from a childhood experience of like, you learn that, don't you? I certainly did. I learned to be smart mouthed because I wasn't very good at running and I wasn't very good at being the pretty one. So it's like, I'm going to have to chat my way out of the shit.
Right.
Every situation, I'm going to have to work out how to do it.
That's it. And I think especially with the women, we look back on our childhood experience and we were never the class clown or a real standout popular sex symbol for our sense of humor. It's all defense mechanism based for the most part.
So as an outsider in a Canadian, what, high school?
Yeah. Well, Canadian every school.
So they would be, because all I know, I've never been to Canada, but my received that kind of ideas are that the social groups are much more defined than they are in UK schools. Of course, you've got nerds and blah, blah, blah. But for example, in a UK school, you don't get jocks. You don't get, I mean, how much of that sort of typical kind of social groupings are like real in sort of Canadian schools? How much of it is just bullshit from TV and movies?
I think we had that probably less so than you see in movies, only because our school board budgets are smaller, so we had less serious sporting groups, but we certainly had jocks and we definitely had cool kids and pretty girls and preppy girls. And then we had skaters and then the druggy group that would hang out in the smoking section. And it's funny how generations go along, because in my year group, it's so dependent on exactly the year you were born as well. Because when I was in high school, it was not considered cool to be a rebel or to smoke. We were kind of the snooty, popular girls by that point. And then my sister is 5 or 6 years younger than I am. And all of a sudden she was really cool and beautiful. And she was smoking though, and like hanging out with drug kids and hanging out with skater boys. And that became cool all again. So whether or not you're a smoker, in my experience, just solely depends on the fashion and the year you were born. Weird.
It's true, because I didn't know anybody when I was a kid and when I was at university who didn't smoke. Yeah. All of us smoked. And we got to about 35 and went, what do you mean this shit's bad for you? Because we had no context other than stinking smoking rooms and other people we knew smoking.
Yeah.
And it was just like, that's, but for me, smoking was always about, if I've got a lit thing, so I was super shy. If I can drink so much that I can barely string a sentence together, I've got this lit thing that I can wave around. No one's going to get in my immediate, I can't be got at, do you know what I mean? I can't, I've got my little protection. I've got my little crew with me. I'm off my tits and I've potentially got a weapon.
That's really cool. So you were part of the leather jacket, smoking, rock and roll.
We were more scatty than that. There was nothing, you make it sound like a sort of spin-off of Grease, which would be much more acceptable. It was basically quite a lot of charity shop clothes, lots of quite nervous people, quite a crossover with people who read, so lots of people who read books. Quite a few pretentious people who read sort of, I don't know, Nabokov or something. And then people who'd been quite beaten and sort of fucked over. So it was quite a good crossover group, united by a hatred of our lungs.
I would have loved to be in that group if I'd had that as an option. I wish I was with the intellectuals. I mean, no disrespect to my group of friends, but I wish I'd been with the intellectuals. There was no one like that. And when I first moved to the UK, I saw you and Mel at one of my first gigs, Sarah Pascoe at one of my first gigs, Joe Lycett. I felt all of a sudden like all this, what would be considered alternative comedy, seemed very mainstream and very accessible and very cool.
So what was the Canadian comedy scene like? If you're saying that, if that felt alternative to you, what were people doing in Canada? What was the main vibe there comedically?
Well, I can't speak for all of Canada because I was in Toronto and I certainly found groups that were more alternative. But what you would see headlining on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday was all white men for the most part. And the material was quite violent and hateful and sexual, if you really want to dissect it. And I don't fault anyone for that. I just think that is what was considered comedy. It was still, you know, I hate my wife, my girlfriend, so disgusting. And I was dating someone at the time who would go on stage and speak that way about me, like talk about my body, how disgusting it was, how
what?
He gifted me his ex-girlfriend's vibrator, how like, and then I adopted a lot of that persona. I go, okay, read the room. What's the vibe? The vibe is I'm a dumb whore. Got it. And then when I started comedy, it was very much, I had this giggle and it was like, I don't know. I'm just such a dumb whore. Sorry to say whore twice, three times in a row.
You can say whore as many times as you like.
But I just felt like, I mean, there were people brave enough and loads of female comics that I saw who deviated from that. But headlining Friday, Saturday, no, that's what you got.
I'm still getting over the fact that your boyfriend spoke about you in any context, private or publicly, like that. But certainly publicly made currency, made a living out of denigrating you.
Well, I didn't make a living at it, did he? But tried.
You had the last laugh. But that's awful. It's awful. But then I think about my own experience. And I suppose I started seeing a lot of stand-up comedy when I was first at college. So when I was sort of 18. And actually, although, you know, perhaps you could sort of feel that, you know, that London in particular, London and Manchester at that time were the sort of havens of alternative comedy. At 18, I was regularly seeing guys come to university and I just remember lots of comics mimicking sex. So there'd be loads of comics just grinding. They'd come and say, "Hey!" And then they'd be like, my wife / my girlfriend, and then just grinding.
Yeah.
And then she loves it and then just watching this guy. And I remember there was one guy who was miming, like picking his wife up. So he had this enormous, vast sort of mimed bulk.
Ooh.
And he was just sort of shagging her. It was like, what is this? And then, of course, the only woman on the bill that I ever saw when I was 18, 19 was Jo Brand, who was always so gifted. But her early stuff, it's almost... It's brilliantly written, but it's almost unwatchable. It's an exercise in self-loathing, which is exactly as you've described. It was, how can I get to myself in the most, how can I take all my beautiful energy and creativity and turn it to darkness and then impale myself with it?
Yeah.
All fat jokes, all I'm disgusting. I mean, her act was called The Sea Monster at the time.
Oh.
Yeah. And she'd come on and she was the funniest. the funniest soul of the night, but it was, and I loved her. I was totally like, this is everything, because she was so strong. But in retrospect, God, imagine if she'd been allowed at the time to send that outwards into the world. Do you know what I mean? If her material had been outward bound.
And allowance is a big part of it, because I don't mean to blame anyone for the culture at that time. That's what audiences wanted. That's what everyone was made to believe was comedy. You certainly didn't find an audience of women at that time who wanted to see other women at the club I was going to. And I just think that's why it's difficult when we transport acts from 20 years ago, 10 years ago into today and judge them based on the cultural parameters that we have now. It just doesn't make sense, because we did what we had to do at the time, and we wouldn't articulate ourselves in the same way today. But that's the beauty of growth.
And also, you have got this sort of outlier sort of, I think, moment in each and every year, which is the Edinburgh Festival, which for comics is a chance to do something very unique, which is their 1 hour. And there's always been a history, certainly for as long as I've been going, which is a long time, of comics being able to jettison that sort of club vibe and do something more personal, more narrative, more theatrical in some senses. And I think that is utterly, that place more than any other, I think, is responsible for the way that comedy changes all the time.
Probably, because that is a huge difference. When I came to the UK, in Canada, we have the Just for Laughs Festival, obviously, but those are not hour-long narrative shows in a fringe setting. And I noticed that when I came here, it was so varied and very self-authored and authentic and loads of different voices, even though there was still a long way to go at that time, 2006, 2007. I immediately noticed the difference, and I loved it here, and I love the pub culture here, and the fact that pre-lockdown, you could go to comedy any night of the week.
And it's all different. And actually, part of the joy of Edinburgh is not just seeing the successes. I've seen some of the maddest shit in my life there. Yeah. I've seen Brazilians pooing in a cave.
No.
And I still don't know what. Yes, genuinely ended on, and word had got out, like, it ends with someone shitting. And you went, and it did. I mean, this was about 15 years ago now. And it seems to me, as I say it out loud, to be a dream, but I know I saw it. And I remember walking past a shop, and there was a show just beginning, and I went in, and the show ended with a projector and a sort of short white sheet, and she projected onto it Travis Bickle, so you know, Travis Bickle's face, and she took her clothes off and she did a handstand and split her legs, and she'd had this incredible sort of mohawk vagina sculpted and it hit just at the point where Travis Bickle's mohawk was, and that was the end of the show. I thought, that is that's really an ending that we should all be aspiring to, and that's why I love Edinburgh.
Well,
because even though it's almost unwatchable, it's memorable.
I mean, you can hinge your ending on a handstand. You can be pretty confident that you can hit that handstand, but how do you schedule a closing poo?
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's
no wonder this Edinburgh show was so memorable, because the sheer regularity of performing that move as a closer every night should be applauded.
Maybe, I mean, one doesn't know. There was a team of them. They were very robotic and incredibly beautiful young men. Maybe they took it in turns. Maybe they were sort of, as they were dancing and expressing themselves in the cave, there was a sort of gesture that one gave, which is, do you know what? I could probably just coil this summer. I don't mind taking one for the team today. One doesn't know. Yeah. As I say, I only had that. It was an amazing gig in a phone box once, where you got picked up in a cab and then taken to a phone box, and somebody did a play at you in a phone box.
Oh, thank you.
It was so intense being an audience member, because obviously all eyes on me, and I had to give some feedback afterwards. And just on a basic economic level, it's not going to work, is it?
No, I mean, there's art, and then there's paying your rent. You know, I mean, what are you really doing when you're holding one audience member hostage and your expenses are probably more than the cost of the ticket?
Yeah.
The next thing you know, you'll be part of a pooing Brazilian troupe. People have to be business minded about this industry as well.
It's fair to say 2020 has been a pretty stressful year for all of us. And we're all looking for ways to reduce anxiety and stress. Well, our long-term sponsors, Grass & Co., can help with that. Grass & Co. is a premium CBD range that blends the highest quality CBD with therapeutic botanical ingredients. The organic CBD and botanical formulations have been specially created to relax your mind and soothe your body. Find your lockdown calm with grassandco.com. The best-selling Calm CBD range includes botanicals evening primrose, ashwagandha, chamomile, marula and mint to bring balance to your day. To find out more, head over to grassandco.com/hour. If you're new to CBD, the best-selling 500mg Calm CBD oil is a brilliant starting point. And as with all supplements, CBD affects everyone differently. So just start low and steadily build the dosage every day until you find the balance that works with your body. My favourite is the Calm Balm, some thick, magnificent goop that I can pour all over my aching joints that makes me feel just fabulous at the end of a long day. Grass & Co. have supported the podcast since the start, and you can now get 25% off the entire Grass & Co. Calm, Ease and Rest CBD ranges. Plus, you'll get free shipping. Just head over to www.grassandco.com/hour and use the discount code HOUR, that's H-O-U-R, at checkout. You really won't regret it. Grass & Co., life enhanced by nature.
So you've got to go. You don't know what you're going to say yet. Have you got a title for it? But you have. Come on.
Yes, it's called Mrs.
Ah, which presumably discusses the change in your personal situation, she said euphemistically. So you've been civilly partnered, haven't you?
Yeah. And I mean, my whole life is different now. It's something that I really resisted. I never thought would happen. My last show was a real anthem to different shapes of a family and living your life in an unconventional way. I mean, it's pretty shocking that just being a single woman is very unconventional, but I mean, whatever. And then I went and got civil partnered. So yeah, my life has been an adjustment, and I would like to talk about that because I think I alienate a lot of the people with my strong, powerful women stuff. And now what can I say? I'm a failure to them.
No, never. You remain the queen of that, but also bringing in new flavors. The thing is, I mean, I don't know much about this story other than what floats across, I don't know, sort of generic media that's hit me, but this is such a romantic story. So you were like childhood sweethearts, you drifted apart and then you reconnected.
Yeah, well, it's less romantic than that. He was my first boyfriend when I was 16. I loved him. That's when I still believed in love. And then we split. You know how much you love someone when you're 16. It's like, yes, everything is so amplified. And I did always think about him, but I put it down to being 16. I thought, oh, well, I probably remember that so fondly because I'd never been hurt yet. You know, I'd never paid tax yet. Everything was great. And then I went home to film Who Do You Think You Are in Canada. And I pretty much bumped into him in a pub. And of course I was drinking. And I decided that it would be funny if we went home together. It would be a lovely story for all of our friends. And I really just did it for a joke. And then he was just so lovely to me, really mature, like texting me right away while I continued through the Arctic on this Who Do You Think You Are tour of Canada. And then it was
just... Why do they have to come from the cold bits of Canada?
Yeah, of course, my family. I'm like, Bahamas? I'm like, look at your skin. No. I've lived indoors in the snow for thousands of years.
You've basically been igloo-based generations back. That's it.
And then we were pretty much civil partnered 6 months later. It just moved really quickly. And I learned that when something makes sense, you don't have any reservations. You don't have to ask any questions. It really is just easy, 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 easy. And I wish someone had told me that because I never saw myself getting married or letting a man live in my house or any of the above. And it just happened so organically that there was no excuse. I just couldn't think of any reason not to. And here I'd spent so much.
And had he been, you know, had he had the same sort of wistfulness about you that you'd had about him all these years?
Who knows? Of course he'll say that. But I mean,
I love the fact you're still deeply suspicious.
Yeah.
Everything's worked out. I don't trust what he says.
Well, he's very handsome and my family suspected foul play. And did that's hurtful, isn't it? It's no. really hurtful when everyone in your life goes, wait a minute, he's up to something here. He
you
likes you or
cross, sure? Both of you. You both look great and you both look so, yeah, it's meant to be. And that's nice because actually a lot of people in your position, i.e., you know, creative and then this our world, would try and do exactly what you suggested, which is fight against the happiness.
Mm.
What am I if I'm not sort of troubled, fucked up, constantly questioning? But you've just gone, nope.
Well, I was happy by myself. That, I think, is the key, the road to my success, is when I was in all these troubled relationships, I felt that I had to be. I felt shame for being a single mother or for having been a failure in my previous relationship. And I have this, I think, ancestral trauma where if things go badly in my relationship, it's up to me and I can fix it and don't worry. And if it gets worse, I'll dig my heels in and watch this. I can fix it. And if I make it okay in the end, none of this actually happened. And it was only when I spent a year very, very single that I was truly happy. And that's when I wrote that show, Glitter Room. And I went, oh my gosh, you don't have to subscribe to all these ideas of the shape of a person or what type of whole individual you have to be. I was so happy alone. And that's when I found him.
And I mean, you say alone, but you have this extraordinary relationship with your daughter.
Yeah.
So, and who is such an independent, I mean, I've only met her, I think twice, but such an independent spirit. I was very struck by that. What a fully formed little person she was already. Like out of the box, of course it isn't out of the box, it ties with your parenting and the relationship you have. But interesting that you saw yourself as, you know, as a sort of single person, but probably because she's also so singular. So the two of you can kind of coexist, but in unique worlds.
Well, this might be a little too Edinburgh for you, but I was thinking with the show title, Misses, I was like, is there some artistic way where I can part the letters and make it Miss Us at the end? Because I really do miss that relationship that I had with her and that time in my life as well.
So that's an interesting thing though, isn't it? That people don't talk about, so perfect in a way for a show, in that you have this time as a single person and the reward is that you have this incredible clarity in your relationship with your daughter. And then that gets, I don't want to say muddied because I don't want to bring anything negative into that because obviously you're really, really happy. But so what is the shift?
Well, I think the shift was happening anyway, and whatever incarnation of the universe you believe in, I almost think that goddess was like, Catherine, you need a new partner in crime because this one doesn't want to be friends with you anymore. And I did rely on Violet, my daughter, to be my best friend. And we were so close and we slept in the same bed and we lived in this democracy, just so, so close for so many years. And then I could feel that slipping away. And I think what potentially a lot of single parents might be doing when they construct their lives that way is really setting themselves up for an early empty nest syndrome, because children do go to secondary school. She's 11 now. She's invested in her community there. I'm not that cool anymore. She has other influences and other people she wants to hang out with. And all of a sudden I've been massively demoted. And it really hurts. I think a lot of people feel that when the kids go to uni or whatever they do, they move out. But this year has really struck me that she's gone. And I feel guilty because I know people who've actually, you know, God forbid, lost their children. I know my daughter is still here, but that little person is definitely gone. And that is a real trauma for me. That's hard.
I think I'm not lucky enough to be a parent, but I'm a godmom and I'm an aunt. And but it seems to me that there's an art of losing a child in plain sight.
Yeah,
there are periods of such intense connectivity, obviously most profoundly when they can't speak and they're sort of physically attached to you. But the letting go is, I don't know how you do that. So my sister's just had a baby and I just want to eat this little thing. She's just permanently on me and she still smells milky and she's giggling all the time. And I just think, no, I don't want you. Then you're here now. Don't you be leaving. I can't imagine how hard that is when, as you say, they're 11 and they're like, I got my own shit going on.
Right. Well, congratulations. Yeah. They're so cute when they're babies.
Yeah, they are cute.
And I've done a terrible thing to my parents. I mean, my mother loves me. Everyone in my family loves me because I'm so cool. And I moved an ocean away and I had a baby over here and I hardly even call them. I mean, I am an evil, terrible daughter.
You're a shit daughter.
Yeah.
And I Violet really is their revenge upon you.
She really is. And I've been dumped. So Bobby swooped in to sort of hold my attention so that I don't end up in an institution because it's broken my heart.
But when do you reckon she'll come right around again? Because she will, you know she will, because the bond is forged. It's not going anywhere. She's just taking a break, right? So when's the next point of need, do you think?
I think they say like 21, 23, but I don't know.
You don't know, but you've obviously been reading about it. Well, definitely some reading has happened there.
Yeah. They say it gets worse before it gets better. They're like, oh, you're having trouble and she's 11. But because I've done it all wrong. I gave her so much power so early on. She does not understand how all of a sudden she and I are not equals. And we were equals when, you know, she was always following the rules and just being really lovely and benevolent. But she's all of a sudden a communist. And
oh, is she? Okay. How does that manifest in sort of daily life?
I mean, she loves lockdown. She wants to live on the computer. She just wants to stay home and sort of do nothing. And
that's your version of communism.
Well,
they just stayed at home on Fortnite, did nothing.
Well, that's what it will be, you know, when we all just get this furlough to be like trapped under this weird new government scheme. You know, I'm quite scared about what's going on, and Violet is here for it. She loves it, and she doesn't have so much to push against like I did. That's my worry, that I wonder how resilient she is and if her life has just been too lovely, because I still really admire her. I think she's hilarious. She's really good company, but she's so laid back that if a test goes really well, she says, oh yeah, I got perfect on that test. Equally, if she gets zero on the test, she's like, eh, look at that. I got zero on that test. She just doesn't care. And
for me, that's just healthy. I'd rather have that than me going, because the thing is, if I get perfect on a test, I don't trust the test.
Oh.
If I do less than perfectly on a test, I'm an idiot. Welcome to my world. And it's that kind of self-defeating madness that I'm really glad that your baby doesn't have, because that's a good way to be. She tries her best. It doesn't roll. It's okay.
There you go. It's my anxiety-free DNA that has trickled down.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Harrys.com. And if you haven't heard of them, they're a subscription service for men's shaving products at affordable prices. The company was set up by Jeff and Andy, who were fed up with overpriced razors and set out to fix shaving. To do this, they bought their own factory in Germany, which has been making blades for 100 years, and had just released their sharpest ever blades with a new lubricating strip for an even closer and more comfortable shave. And the best part? Harry's haven't raised prices, so you can get replacement blades for as little as £1.75 each. Listeners to this podcast can now get a trial set for just £3.95. The set includes a weighted ergonomic handle, the new 5-blade razor cartridge, shave gel and travel blade cover to protect your blades on the move. Go to harrys.com/hour to get started. You can also check out Harry's range of face care and hair care products, as well as their shave and shower travel kits. Get the comfortable shave you deserve. Head over to harrys.com/hour to claim a trial set for just £3.95. And you'll be supporting our podcast by doing so.
What you need to do in this lockdown is perhaps release. And I'd really be into you doing this, actually, because there wouldn't be this sort of wraparound spiritualism. It'd be very, very deep, deep Canadian pragmatism.
Yeah.
Just like, rid yourself of this bullshit. And I would subscribe, and I would happily listen to every day, just an hour with Catherine Ryan saying, you know, they'd have permission to live in your head. You are enviably anxiety free.
I am. And I think it's so simple. It's so silly, really. I just feel very lucky to be alive. Every day I'm like, oh, wow, it's all still here. And then I just don't let anybody
No, it is.
Bother me. So Cardi B says, I don't bother with these hoes. Don't let these hoes bother me. And I really connect with that material.
I need to be more Cardi B, you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
To be honest, I haven't really been, I've not, it's studied in, as intensively as I should have done the lyrics and made them a personal mantra. But I, you know what, if it's, if it works for you, I'm down with it. So Miss Us is good. I like that. And I like the idea that it follows on from Glitter Ball, the idea that you think life is one thing. And you've almost, as you say, made a career currency out of the strong woman who has no need of anything because you have a degree of self-containment. So just change it up and go, shit happens. I'm going to embrace the new normal.
I love that we're workshopping it now.
I can't tell you anything about jokes. I'm never going to presume to workshop any of your stuff.
No,
but helpful. I like that. Because also it's going to really challenge what other people think is your shtick, your brand, which is a sort of, as you say, a kind of fuck you world. And is a much more, I don't know. I'm interested to see it.
Ooh, thank you.
I'll come and see it. It'll be, presumably, you're going to have to hit it hard now. We're all so bored of being shoved in. You will be doing, you'll be in Cumbernauld. That's how deep this tour is going to go. And I've gigged in Cumbernauld. But you'll be in every town, city, village hall just to get out and about, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully. I can't wait. And I took a year off touring and I was working on my Netflix series. And that was such a shift. I was like alone in exactly this room, just writing scripts. And I feel that comedy is such a conversation. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
But I think live comedy is just so integral to what we do. Otherwise, you might as well be a presenter.
Mm. Which also I have dallied with, but I'm lucky to do it with a mate because, but for me, that's why I was never good in, any good at stand-up is because I was waiting for the feedback, waiting for the banter, I suppose. And I never was able to harness the audience as a willing participant.
Well, I think that's your perception. I think that's absolutely wrong. I think you're a brilliant stand-up. And every time I see you presenting, you're not a presenter, you're comedian presenting, which I think is a wonderful thing and comes through in all of your work. You can't un-comedian yourself.
I'm just me, but that's taken a while. I think I like watch stuff from like, I don't know, 15 years ago and I speak completely differently.
Yeah.
I'm trying to pretend that I'm really sort of clever. And when I do that, I sort of put on a voice that's quite slightly higher pitched. So as you were saying, like, love me, slightly needy, wide-eyed, innocent, conformist, so the voice gets posh because I think that's how people on television should speak. Over the years, as I've sort of aged and sagged, I've just gone, oh Christ, you know, the odd Croydon vowel will very much poke through, and I'm glad of it, really, because especially at the moment, I mean, I think proper comics like you have always, you know, good comics like you have always understood authenticity being a backbone, because no one laughs at fraud. They're like, something's wrong here. Yeah. Something is getting in the way of the jokes.
You're right. And that's the type of comedy that I'm attracted to, is when I feel like it's my best friend telling me a secret. That's when I really want to know and I get drawn in. And I'm not a proper comic or a good comic, by the way. I mean, I am harshly reviewed, and I don't care.
Are you? Okay, well, listen, the not caring is great, but I don't read reviews, so I don't know. But, you know, I can only see it from my perspective, which is that you've been one of a few female comics who've dramatically changed the landscape for other female comics. I really do believe that. And there's no bullshit here.
Yeah.
In the same way that I saw Jo Brand when I was a kid, people will have seen you, and that transforms their landscape. And that's massive. I mean, I'm struggling. I mean, I suppose people could be maybe intimidated by you, because as you say, you have this, what seemed like a crystalline sense of self. And I'm jealous of it. I'm sure other people are. It's just that my jealousy forms into a kind of admiration, and rather than a jealousy and a nastiness.
No. Well, yeah, I think we all take baby steps for each other. And I absolutely really recognize Jo Brand and all the others who came before me and all the ones who will come after me. I think it really is this team effort. But I wish that I could take people's anxiety away. It makes me so sad when I think that someone like you doesn't just walk around naked thinking you're brilliant 24 hours a day. I hate that you're thinking about trolls. I hate that. And I'm going to try.
I don't get trolled that much though. I don't, and I don't always get reviewed. I don't get reviewed particularly badly. When there's some, you know, there's some old favourites who literally sort of believe that I should be sort of tethered to a stake and eaten by donkeys. But most anxiety, of course, is generated from a sort of outdated opinion of ourselves that doesn't come from anybody. But so if we follow the line that you're changing, then how does the Duchess change? Which is a cracker, by the way. How does that is a show absolutely vested in the experience of being a single mother in London, being halfway around the world from where you were born and making and forging a new life. Is the show going to change as you've changed, or is the Duchess resolutely not Catherine Ryan, you know, in a second season?
I mean, the Duchess is really interesting for me, and thank you so much for watching it. I always love the process of seeing how people react to something, and I learn from that, and then my material is reactive to that. And I think the Duchess was a lot for people because it is an unapologetically wealthy and fashionable single mother who's an artist, and she prioritizes her relationship with her daughter, and men are simply not a priority. And it really touches on the biological injustice that whether you choose to have children or not, women are expected to figure out that legacy in their 20s, ideally, in their 20s. And if the shoe were on the other foot, gender-wise, I really think that problem would be fixed. And it's unreasonable, and it is a fucking abomination. And this woman has a lot of resentment toward her ex, and she does have a lot of righteous anger, but her behavior is very sympathetic and virtuous and sacrificial. She doesn't really act for herself. She prioritizes the relationship with the child's father, her actions. She's the one who financially and physically looks after this child. The father, by the way, has a wonderful, fun life. Lives on a boat, thinks he's killing it, finds love because he holds no resentment, doesn't get judged for his romantic choices by his daughter because he's just the dad, ends up having two babies in the end without even trying, even though he's in his 40s. I mean, all of that stuff is really important to me to communicate. And what do people take away from it? They go, she's really nasty and we don't understand why she's rich. And I'm like,
but I think, but that's the, in a way, that's the point of it. That's the, that's the idea that money in makes some things so easy and has absolutely no bearing on others, on other things. You know what I mean? It's money. There's a barrier that it hits. And then beyond that point, you can't buy your way out of a feeling, or as you say, in this case, a kind of, millennial long kind of heavy sort of sense of shit on female shoulders. And I love the unapologetic nature of it. As you say, the stylish nature of it. It's just like, here it is. And it just lands knowing what it is. And I think that's very rare for a series, actually. There's a lot of, I write a bit and first steps are hard because you sort of feel that you should give the game away. Mm. And actually what's great is when you watch something, it just goes, here I am, you'll catch up. Here I am, you might not like me now, I might explain my choices, I might not.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're intrigued and you go, whoa, there's, and also I really like, and I think especially now we get to see more of them, I like angry women on screen. I like angry, you know, feisty, fiery, fucked up people going, I'm not going to carry that anymore just for you.
But isn't it interesting that we are so judged on our behavior more than our actual actions? All of this woman's actions are virtuous, and all of her behavior is really, on the surface, really nasty and angry. But it's I think anger often comes from pain, and these are boundaries that she's trying to protect herself with. And it's easy for some people to see that. It's very difficult for others to see that. So I'm intrigued by that. And I don't know if I would write more or where I would go with it if I wrote more, but I love that it just stands alone as this almost bananas rom-com.
Yeah, it's true that. And the the process of, so you're in the room where you write. There's nothing more painful and beautiful than writing, I think. And it's when you say people have a pop at you or whatever, you want to take them into that room, and you want to show them what it's like to stare at a sort of blank page with this pulse and cursor and think, I've got to populate a whole world for you.
Yeah.
I've got to try and do that from nothing, from just a few bits in my head. And I've got to make these characters psychologically credible. I was just sitting at the day, I'm writing something, and I've written a big, you know, you write these Bibles, they're called, aren't they? You, for those who don't know what that is, you basically, it's a sales document. For me, this one was about 40 pages long, and it sets out the world and all the characters and how they might, you know, interrelate. I'd done all that, and I sat down to write the first episode. And this 40-page Bible just said, they all meet. And I then had to think, but how do they meet? And there's six people. Who meets who first? Does somebody get offended by one of them? What would they say? They can't all say hello the same way. How do they speak? What's the even for? Is somebody a little bit cooler than everyone else? In which case I might have to investigate jargon from the 80s. All of that. So in whatever people think of what you produce or what I produce, we have to remember there's been so much intent. There's been so much quiet and solitary intent, and we don't mean to bore people or fuck people off, but sometimes we do. But there's so much time, solo time, gone into it. And that's why I'm always amazed when people, like Ethan, get stuck. Like an hour of stand-up represents to me an almost holy grail of brutality and loneliness and failure and redemption, because you've tested it and it's failed. I mean, God, I remember sitting in a Battersea Arts Centre and, you know, just having things written on my hand and, you know, bits of paper, and then just realising almost the joke hadn't yet come out of my mouth, and just thinking, move on, because you just know it's dead. You know, it's like it's died in your mouth already.
Yes.
Listen, I sound like I'm doing a sort of like one of those really sinister Radio 4 appeals for comics, but I don't know. We do try, don't we?
Well, of course. And sometimes I think, stand up for all the loneliness and for all the solitude, I almost prefer that, because when you're writing scripts, you know, I mean, I very famously don't like to rely on anyone else. I like to be by myself. All of a sudden, there are other people who have notes on your script and who have ideas and who say, yeah, well, she wouldn't say that. And you go, she's me. And they go,
I created it.
Yeah. And that was a real adjustment for me. And a lot of good came out of it. I learned a lot, but I don't normally have to collaborate. So I don't know how you do that, because you write so much television, so many brilliant scripts. Do people leave you alone?
No. I mean, I've just learned with notes, actually, that I was so disturbed by them at first, because I took them as a sort of criticism of the world. And I'm a control freak like everybody else. I'm like, all these lines are in there for a reason. But I try and lean in now. And I actually, every time someone's made a note, even a bad note, the script's got better, because it's forced me to look at something in a different way. I take your point that if someone's saying they wouldn't say that, that would probably annoy me, because I'm thinking, I've been sitting with these mental people in my head for months. Yeah. But I really, it's very hard to let people in, isn't it? It's very, very hard, because so much of the work takes place in the locked in chambers of our brain. Right. That when you get it out, it's like, why can't you just accept it and we'll all move on?
Yeah, I know.
I've done it now. Can we just make it? And I'll accept if it's not very good. But actually, increasingly, I think even if it's a silly thing, it'll make me think about something that is important.
Yeah.
I guess. But I mean, that's after a lot of swearing. The first time I get notes in, for the next hour, I won't have anyone around me. It will just be, how dare the grandiosity is unreal. You didn't understand what I was trying to say. And then the blood pressure calms down and I think, I mean, I really can just scythe all of that scene because it's just shit, or, you know, whatever. But I think it's good for the collaboration, and it's good to sometimes be jolted out. I do think that, but it is hard. It is hard. Do you ever show, like, do you show first drafts to your partner? Does he, is he somebody that you kind of can get involved with creatively?
I do. I started sending Bobby first drafts. He's very funny and he's very different to me too. He is what one would think you and I, politically, socially speaking, might not gravitate toward. He kind of represents this mystical white male that I didn't know much about. And he's not as, like, you know, woke as a lot of my friends here in the creative community. So he's actually very good as a sounding board because he's a little different. But then I also involve my stylist and my friend, Jen. She styled the Duchess. She's called Jennifer Mahalski Bray. She's a good friend of mine and she has no background in comedy, but we've just worked together for 8 years. And it's really important to have people like that on your team. I think people who've known you a long time, I think, you know, even though she doesn't have a background in script writing, she knows me very well and knows the, like, voice that I'm trying to get across.
Yeah. It's interesting that neither of them are professionals. I think that's good, actually, because there's nothing arch about their notes. They're just for the good of you. Do you know what I mean?
Professionals can have all the opinions they want and they can write all the articles that they want without ever having created anything themselves. And they can be all holier than thou, but they aren't the audience at the end of the day. So I really don't care that much what most of them think. I like to show it to an audience. And if they think it's funny, and if people I respect, you know, my friend Emily Dean is another one. She's an author and she's so funny. She has a radio show with Frank Skinner on Saturdays.
Yeah, she's cool.
I don't even care then if someone else says it's not funny, because I'll be like, you idiot, Emily Dean thinks it's funny. So I don't care.
I'm like that with Melanie, but the thing is, we're just hardwired to find each other so hilarious, like two toddlers in a pram. But on reflection, she's never really the best sounding board, because I'll go out there having road tested on her and die on my ass and go, what's happened here?
No, she's perfect. Don't you think Monty Python were just a bunch of lads who laughed at each other like toddlers? You know, like, there are loads of people who just persist with that authenticity. They make each other laugh. And as soon as it gets poisoned by too many voices, it's not the same.
It's true. It's true that.
So your instinct is right.
So you will now go and get the fragments of brain droppings that have been collecting in your head over lockdown. And then you'll move this into a sort of script for the tour, roughly when? When's your deadline?
Oh, gosh. Well,
when
I
do you start your tour? Is it May? March?
It starts in September.
Next September. Okay, you've got time.
Yeah, I'm doing a few gigs between then. I've got a few other commitments. But I have all these notes in my phone. That's how I do it. I just put bullet points in my phone, things I've been thinking about, ruminating. And then I write them out with a pen. Do you remember pens?
I always write everything with a pen.
You use a pen. See, I love that.
I use a pen. Yeah, and sometimes my favourite thing is actually a pencil.
Ooh.
Yeah, I don't know why. It reminds me of school, maybe, but I just have a lined notepad and a pencil, and then I can cross things out and fiddle around with things and rub things out if I need to.
It's so satisfying, isn't it? I think it puts it in a different part of your brain.
I think you're absolutely right. You have to physically draw it out. Yeah. Physically draw it out and put it on the page. Then you've got random notes, and they'll be sort of thoughts rather than jokes at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then you write them down, and then the jokes start forming around the thoughts.
Right. And then I know I need to have a premise and to be clear and to have a few punchlines, and then I'll go to, you know, the Tommy Field. I'll do some open mic or London comedy night that I can, and I'll work out little bits of it. And, you know, that's how it goes until you have a tour.
This is another thing, is that, you know, by the time people see your show, you will have, you'll have tried and failed in 100 other venues to get it to the point it's at.
Yeah. I mean, already I try things out on people. Like, I thought it was really funny, and it's not, by the way, because I've done this enough times and no one laughs. Is that, because I'm laughing at my husband's medical diagnosis. My husband was falling asleep around 5 p.m., really exhausted. And I thought, oh my gosh, like, maybe he'll die. I'll get so many beautiful flower arrangements. I'm a newlywed. This is so cool. And then we took him to the doctor because I thought he must have low iron. Something's wrong. we went to the doctor and he explained sort of his situation moving over here from Canada. And he doesn't understand any regional accent. He really struggles. We have to watch TV with subtitles on. We know an Irish neighbor, anytime Jim speaks to Bobby, Bobby's like, Jim yelled at me. He doesn't understand a word Jim's saying. Don't even attempt Scottish Welsh. He cannot understand. Okay. And he's been out golfing. He's met a few friends. He knows a few different regionally accented British people. And the doctor said he has this actual condition called foreign language exhaustion, which people get.
20 having minutes, don't fuck for him.
I thought it was funny. People get this from having to learn and make sense of a new language, but this new language is simply English, but Bobby can't hack it.
That's very funny. Why do you think it's funny?
I think it's funny.
It makes me laugh. It's really funny.
People worry when I tell them.
It's the lamest diagnosis. The idea that he's falling asleep at 5 because his brain can't accommodate the same language, but it's just delivered in a slight dialect.
I think you have to understand Canadians to really believe it. I think people don't buy it, but you have to know.
I want to know more about the doctor. That, I mean, do you know what I mean? For me, right, what's funny about that is if I went to see a doctor and I said I'm feeling tired, he would run a shed load of tests to do with my heart. Not this dude. He's gone, I got it. You just moved over from Canada. You're exhausted because you're trying to understand Welsh and Irish. This is an incredible doctor. This is a doctor that's working on a completely different level to any other GP practicing in the UK. This is gold.
Well, maybe I need to explain that bit then, that the GP did run blood tests and the GP himself has like a very Essex accent or something.
Okay.
And Bobby.
Did Bobby understand him? Oh, Bobby didn't understand him.
No, not at all. And I had to be there and translate. And then a nurse came in and he didn't understand her. And the doctor was like, do you know, there is something called foreign language exhaustion. And he seems like he's really struggling to speak English.
Even though he was brought up speaking English.
I know.
Honestly, this is madness. And very entertaining. I think you can mine that.
I hope so. I think it's so cute. And he is getting better at it. Violet is useful because she has a British accent, but it's kind of the usual one. But I mean, he challenges himself. He'll turn off the subtitles sometimes. We've not reached Love Island yet. He can't. The subtitles must be on for that.
And then I guess you can sort of gateway him in slowly to sort of Coronation Street, and then you want to hit Taggart. I mean, that's when he's really good. You want to hit early to even early Taggart. And I love the Scottish accent, but that can even for me be a wall of noise.
Yeah.
And there's something, there's an Aberdonian, you know, the Aberdonians speak in, it's Doric, I think.
Oh.
So they have their own sort of language. And there's a Doric soap opera. Correct me if I'm wrong, lovely listeners. That is the goal for him.
Okay.
You'll know he's been cured. It's the most extraordinarily mellifluous sort of load of vowels coming at you. And if you can tolerate that without just falling asleep. I think it's amazing that his response to an Irish accent would be sort of narcolepsy.
Yeah. Well, this is great. I mean, I can't stand it that you said you're not a stand-up, because not only have you workshopped this bit tremendously, given me some real specific, hilarious examples, but you've also maybe solved my problem.
Then I'm really glad that we'll leave it there, because if that will make me less anxious today, to know that I've helped another human being is a thing of joy forever.
You really have.
Thank you. Thank you, sweetheart, for spending time with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sue. It's always a pleasure to see a friendly, genius face.
A huge thanks to Catherine, and The Duchess is available to watch on Netflix. As always, the music in this episode was by Waiting for Smith, and you can listen to more of his tracks on YouTube and Spotify.
Yes, it's true. When I'm down and I'm blue, all I do is stare at you. I'll be heading east to find my peace.